I'm going to begin by reading from Psalm 11. You can follow along or just listen as I read. In the Lord, I put my trust. How can you say to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? For look, the wicked bend their bow, they make ready their arrow on the string, that they may shoot secretly at the upright in heart. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven. His eyes behold, his eyelids test the sons of men. The Lord tests the righteous, but the wicked and the one who loves violence his soul hates. Upon the wicked he will rain coals. Fire and brimstone and a burning wind shall be the portion of their cup. For the Lord is righteous. He loves righteousness. His countenance beholds the upright. I'm going to begin our talk this morning with the third verse. If the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? And I want you to imagine one of these Google Maps Earth, you know, where you can sort of start way up and then you zero in and get closer and closer to whatever the target is. And we're going to do that this morning, beginning with the idea of foundations. Foundations on a house, not beautiful. Foundations on a house, absolutely essential. In 1992, my wife and I looked for a new house after our fifth child was born, and we looked at about 40 different houses. And we would go into the house, and we'd look and see, does it have enough rooms? What's the layout? What's the condition? But, you know, when we finally settled on the house, we said, it looks like this will do. Then we brought two friends whom we trusted, and we said, please look at the foundations. That was the last but essential step. And in one way, it should have been the first step, but it was an essential step. Jesus uses foundations as a metaphor, doesn't he, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. He says, so I'm going to liken everyone who listens to these words of mine and hears them and does them to a man who builds his house on a rock. So the floods come and the winds blow and it stands. But when the foundations are bad and you have something built on sand, then when difficulties come, down they crash. I sort of look at Western history for the last at least 150 years in American history, as Satan aiming to ruin the foundations of both church and social life. By the way, all serious heresies deny something in Genesis 1, 2, and 3. Because to really undermine biblical truth, you have to undermine something in Genesis 1, 2, or 3. One foundation gravely damaged in the thinking of the Western world is the source of truth. It's where the Westminster Confession of Faith begins in chapter 1. And in the 1920s in this country, there's a war over the Bible in the mainline Protestant churches. And that war disrupts church after church. The war is still going on. A lot of churches at this point have pretty well lost their foundations. They don't read the Bible with confidence. They don't look to it as an authority. And so their teachings stray further and further away from the scriptures. There was a second battle over foundations. And this has to do with, what are we? The Bible's teaching, again, we're back in Genesis 1, 2, and 3, if you actually look carefully there. The Bible's teaching is human nature is like this. There is something noble. We are made in the image of God. And there is something quite ignoble. We are given over to sin and rebellion. The foundation destroyed denies both original sin and creation and views us as neither created nor fallen. And that different view of human nature produces all sorts of different approaches to actually dealing with people, writing laws, and thinking what we can and can't do as a society. Third foundation eaten away in our common life in the last 150 years is the entire edifice of biblical sexual ethics. And that has been eaten away for a long time, and now we're getting closer to today's topic. I want to name some famous termites. First, there's the Viennese psychiatrist Sigmund Freud, who in all his writing, although he does not deny the need for restraint, that's part of civilization, nevertheless traces all sorts of human neuroses and difficulties and hang-ups, as we might say, to various sexual difficulties that you have as young children. And the idea of repression becomes a negative thing after reading Freud. Then there's Margaret Mead, who writes a very, very influential book, Growing Up in Samoa. And it hits the American intelligentsia just at the right time. And she goes over to Samoa as a young anthropologist and listens to her informants, who I think discover that she's a gullible American young woman, and they tell her all the stuff she'd like to hear, but none of it's true. And she comes back and writes a book entitled Growing Up in Samoa, in which you have this idyllic utopian society with no sexual repression of teenagers at all. And they run around just having the most wonderful good time, and they grow up without neurosis, happy, no conflict, and it's a wonderful, beautiful place. Now, later work by an Australian anthropologist recently has completely exploded this whole notion. She got the society completely wrong, but the book is immensely influential and makes an awful lot of young, upper middle class professional people long to live in Samoa, right there in New York City. Then there's Margaret Sanger. Margaret Sanger was desperately afraid that this country had too many people of the wrong sort, and so she greatly promoted birth control for the lower classes, especially for the black lower classes. And she's an early proponent of eugenics, which is a very, very widespread policy in this country until the Nazis make it disreputable during World War II. And then we try to forget that we ever did these sorts of things in Virginia and such states, but we did. And Margaret Sanger is a great contributor to that. She is still honored and praised in the whole Planned Parenthood orbit. I have some friends who call it Planned Parenthood. In that whole Planned Parenthood orbit, she is still praised, but she does her part. And then there's Alfred Kinsey. Is it Alfred? Yes, Alfred Kinsey. Alfred Kinsey, who is greatly honored in this area, I understand, does a whole lot of purported social science research on sexual mores and actual practices. His sampling techniques were worse than awful. They were biased, prejudiced, and produced just terribly dishonest results. The guy himself is morally suspect, which is to put it gently. And he is greatly honored here at the Indiana University with several floors in a building that you have to have lock and key to get into. His work is at this point thoroughly discredited. I mean, he makes Margaret Mead look like a precise scientist in comparison, but he contributes his part. And what he contributes is the widespread notion that old distinctions between correct sex and deviant sex. We'll put it that way. Are just foolish distinctions, because when you look at how people actually behave, everything is normal. And so he actually gets rid of norms by doing his studies, concluding everything is normal, even though his, like I say, his sampling and statistics are just dead wrong and way wrong on thing after thing. And finally, no discussion along these lines would be complete without Hugh Hefner. Ah, bless his soul. He's still alive. He's still running around with 20-somethings. Anyway, Hugh Hefner produces Playboy magazine in the 50s, and what today looks really tame is mainstreamed. I can still remember the Playboy magazines openly displayed at all of the bookstores that you could go to in any part of the country. I think now they're much less visible than they used to be. Now let's follow the deterioration of the foundations in a different way. 1950s. This is all my lifetime. Supreme Court overturns all bans on all books so that now anything can be published. And Playboy goes on the market. Pretty tame at those days. 1960s. Cosmopolitan magazine persuades the country that good girls do. on most college campuses, the rules about male-female fraternization disappear. The college that I went to, Swarthmore College, known in its day as the Kremlin on the Krum being this creek that goes through there, nevertheless had extremely restrictive male-female rules. It was just the beginning of visitation, women in the men's dorms until 11 o'clock on Saturday night only, doors open, feet on the floor, and it was enforced. And that was 1964. By 1966, they were gone. All rules were gone. There were no rules. It was that fast. And if you were a student on campus, as I was at the time, it was it left your head kind of swimming. And by the time I graduated, nobody had yet thought of co-ed sex dorms, but we've moved further. That's the 1960s. 1970s. Led by the state of California, Governor Ronald Reagan, we introduced no-fault divorce. And the divorce rate skyrockets, just goes straight up in the 1970s. Everybody says this is okay because children are resilient, they'll be just fine, don't worry about it. What's important is mom and dad be happy, and if they be happier apart, why they should be apart, and nobody should have to prove anybody's at fault, we'll just make it no fault. It's now easier to get out of divorce, you got to have a marriage, than get out of a painting contract. Trust me, you sign a contract to get your house painted, you get that enforced by the courts. Have a covenant of marriage with somebody for life with all kinds of swearing, you go to the court. The court says, okay, you can be out. 1980s, gay sex is mainstreamed. 1990s, pornography becomes ubiquitous. Your kid gets a computer, he's on there, and it's all available in stuff that would make Hugh Hefner's Playboy just seem like nothing. 2000s, we have the issue of men marrying men and women marrying women, and now we're getting towards the question, well, what is marriage? Just to comment, all these termites at this point are thoroughly discredited in most of what they taught and researched. Makes no difference. Their influence remains, and some of them remain praised. The promise of, if we do it this way, we'll have happy adults, seems not to have been borne out in American society. There are lots of studies that ask the same questions in 1960 and the same questions in 2005 that indicate that American adults don't seem to be any happier, maybe less happy than they were in 1960. The promise that if you have legal, safe abortion, that you'll have the end of child abuse, that was the promise, I remember hearing it back in 1970, turns out not to be so. Actually, rates of child abuse seem to have gone up rather than gone down with safe, legal abortion. Women are happier? No, absolutely. Actually, it doesn't seem to have turned out that way. But the revolution rolls on. So the marriage debate today is no longer about adultery. That's a debate of about 100 years ago. It's not really a debate about divorce. So that was the debate in the 1960s and 70s. Now it is about who can marry whom. And in our society, the argument for gay marriage is winning politically, it's winning legally, and it's winning an awful lot of young opinion. I think one of the weaknesses in the foundations is that Christians have not had a sharp, clear definition of marriage. Now, this is not really our fault. Everybody in every society basically knew what marriage is for centuries and centuries. It's implicit in our experience. We know it when we see it. We understand it. But we haven't got a sharp definition. So that when society that wants to change things comes along with a sort of related definition, what I'm going to call the Sesame Street definition, we're a little bit tongue-tied as to how to respond. Here's the Sesame Street definition. By the way, I loved Sesame Street when my oldest were young, and sometime when my middle child was born, I got uneasy with Sesame Street, and my youngest two children didn't watch Sesame Street at all. The program changed in its aim and focus from teaching literacy and numeracy to teaching social attitudes. And Sesame Street definition as of today. When two people love each other very much and want to spend their lives together, they get married. Sesame Street definition. What is marriage? Marriage is about two people who love each other very much and wish to spend their lives together. And a lot of Christians hear that and feel vaguely uneasy. But that sounds pretty good to our society. We have for a long time maximized our thinking about the romantic aspect of marriage, love between husband and wife. And we have minimized other aspects of marriage, which we'll get to. And so we're already pretty heavily skewed, even in the Christian church, towards being pretty well paralyzed by that word love when somebody brings it forward and says, this is about love. I mean, okay. When somebody tells you this is about love, you say, well, it still stinks. I mean, you don't want to say that. So we're bothered with the Sesame Street definition of marriage, which, by the way, is not the historic way of thinking about it at all. The Westminster Confession of Faith devotes, by the way, an entire chapter to marriage, which I have summarized in a new shorter catechism question. So we're going to offer this to you and then go back to where we're going here. Question 10 is, I think I have the numbers right, how did God create man? God created man, male and female, after his own image and knowledge, righteousness and holiness, with dominion over the creatures. Question 10.5, I wish you were in there, what is marriage? It's in the Confession of Faith. I can go through the Confession of Faith, the four paragraphs, and this summarizes it. Right? What is marriage? Marriage is a covenant of lifelong fidelity between a man and a woman to live together as one flesh for their mutual benefit and for the bearing of children. Now, I'm going to point out one place where I actually disagree with this definition. And you'll listen in what I develop later that I actually somewhat rearrange this definition. This is the Westminster Confession definition. Let me give you the Catholic and the Heidelberg definition, which I actually prefer. What is marriage? Marriage is a covenant of lifelong fidelity between a man and a woman to live as one flesh for the bearing of children and for their mutual benefit. That's the only difference. You'll catch the difference? I rearranged the last two clauses. Just a little word of exhortation before we plunge into the definition. Psalm 11. What do the righteous do if the foundations are destroyed? Well, you've got several choices. You can run away and hide, or you can stand and fight. And the psalmist in his day, this is a long time ago, is speaking to somebody who's advising, just pull in your horns and hunker down and stay out of trouble, run away and hide. And his response is, in the Lord I put my trust. How can you say to me, run away? All right, that's the psalmist's answer to somebody in his own day saying, just you don't need this fight. Just leave. Don't have this fight. Here's the reason to run away. The wicked are well armed and on the advance. And they look pretty hard to beat. That's verse 2. And verse 3, and if the foundations are destroyed, where do you stand to fight? And the answer is in verse 4. The Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven, and his eyes see all that is happening. And the Lord will in the end resist the wicked, and he loves the righteous, and he will behold the upright. But in a fight, there are casualties, and people don't like that. If you get involved in this fight, be ready to be called quickly a bigot and a whole lot of other names that you might think of. Just be glad we live in a society where, by and large, the fighting is limited to nasty name-calling. Not entirely. All right, I want to go back to biology basics. And a little uneasy doing this with Dr. Holdeman sitting back there, because I'm definitely out of my depth in talking a whole lot about biology. Mathematics, I feel more comfortable. Physics, I feel more comfortable. But biology, it is. And I only took one biology course in my life, ninth grade biology. Oh, I hated that course. And that's the only reason I took biology is, you know, this requires. I said, I'm never doing this again. All right, so ninth grade biology, I have a memory of trying to define what are the characteristics of an animal that's alive? All right, so an animal that's alive does certain things, and all animals that are alive do these things. They respirate. That's a big fancy word saying you breathe in and out. They eat food. I'm sure there's a fancy word for that. They eliminate food. We have a variety of words for that. They locomote. I like that. They move around. All right, so all these things tell you that you've got an animal that's alive. There's one more thing animals do. They reproduce. And here there's something quite strange about life. You can't reproduce by yourself if you're in any sort of higher animal. There are a few animals that do this. You know, they just sort of divide little cells. But once you get up to any sort of complex animals, it takes two to reproduce. And the two rather predictably come in two kinds. There's a male kind and there's a female kind. So that when Noah puts animals on the ark, it's two by two. And I don't think anybody in human history needs to be told that when it says two by two, what is intended is one male and one female. Because you can imagine poor Noah after the flood. He really likes camels, and out come the camels, and he said, "Oh my goodness, we got two males." All right, that's the end of the camel race, isn't it? I don't know how many of you have read Robinson Crusoe's novel. Yeah, it's Robinson Crusoe's the novel. Defoe writes it. All right. Daniel Defoe writes it. Robinson Crusoe. All right, so here's Robinson Crusoe. He's a castaway on an island in the Pacific. And Robinson Crusoe does everything necessary for life. He learns how to do it. He can make food. He can eat food. He can eliminate food. He can walk around the island. He's great. He's lonely, but he's alive. And then he discovers somebody else on the island. He sees the footprint in the sand, and he infers from that single footprint there is another man on the island here. Right? He didn't say, well, it might have been just the floods and the tides just produced the footprint. Maybe by chance the footprint got here. Now we get on to the evolution thing, but never mind. All right. He sees the evidence of the footprint, and he says, there's a man here. And he finds the guy on Friday, so he calls the guy Friday. And now he's got company. He's not lonely anymore. He's got somebody to talk to. But have you ever thought, if Robinson Crusoe found 5,000 Fridays, that's still the end of the human race on that island, isn't it? He needs a Mrs. Friday. If there's going to be any long-time future for their existence on this island. In Genesis chapter 1, the Lord says, the scripture says, God made man, male and female, after his own image. And then it says, he said to them, be fruitful and multiply, replenish the earth, have dominion over the creatures. I'm paraphrasing here. And you understand when you read the word instruction, be fruitful, that he's not just talking to Adam. He can't just talk to Adam. If Adam is all by himself, Adam can't be fruitful, not the way God made him. In order to carry out God's command, right from the beginning, when you start reading Genesis 2, if you've got your head, you know, thinking, you say, wait, there's just Adam, and he's got the animals, but there's no animal that suits Adam. And I don't know whether you thought that, well, the trouble is he can't talk to the animals. Maybe that's true. But, you know, the real way no animal suits Adam is he can't reproduce with any of those animals. All right, there's no helper suitable to Adam. All right, there's nobody like the male and female of chapter 1 so that you can be fruitful and multiply. So, after Adam has established dominion over the animals, the Lord then brings him Eve. There are a lot of funny stories, of course, of variations on Adam bringing him Eve. The one I like is he sees Eve and he says, flesh of my flesh, bone of my bones, and she's gorgeous. And then a week later he goes back to God and he says, she is gorgeous, but she talks too much. And God says, all right, I'll take her back. And 3 days later, he goes back to God and he says, I miss her. I miss her laughter. I miss her company. I want her back. God says, okay, you can have her back. 2 days later, he goes back to God and says, God, you know what? It's just no peace around here. God says, you're stuck with her. That's the origin of marriage. All right. Society needs male-female unions or it dies out in 100 years. Just an absolute basic biological fact. And so biological reality is the heart of marriage. And you don't need to know the Bible to know this. You don't even need to be a Christian to know this. If you go to ancient societies, pagan societies, Muslim societies, Chinese society, Japanese society, tribal societies, they're all based on male-female unions producing the next generation. Now I'm going to go back onto a second biological reality, which is this. Our children, in terms of their growing up, are really slow. If you have had dogs, when I was little, we had a female boxer, and she had pups. And, those pups were out running around within a couple of weeks. And by the time they were 6 months old, they could pretty well take care of themselves. By a year, they were really big. And in case of a boxer pup, we didn't have the tails cut, and we discovered why you cut the tails of boxers. They are weapons if you don't have them cut. They're grown. All right, but with humans, what's a human at 1 year? You're still changing his diaper. And at 6 years. And at 12 years. Humans take a long time to grow up. I was just reading a National Geographic article that says the human brain is not really mature until age 25, which matches the insurance company statistics. Turns out the best setting for raising a slow-growing human offspring is with biological father and biological mother. That is the best setting. And one of the crazinesses of our society right now is that is a controversial thing to say right now. It's a controversial thing right now to say that the best setting for a child is with biological father and biological mother. Best setting. Why is that controversial? Well, because it leads straight towards this definition. That's why. That's why it's controversial. Now, it is true that there are other ways to raise children. I'm an example. My father died when I was 6 years old, and so my mother and her three boys moved in with her unmarried sister, and I thank God for her all my life. And so I was raised by two women, my mother and my aunt. All through my childhood, I was both grateful for my aunt and I missed my father. And if somebody had told me, oh, this is just as good as having your father back, I would have screamed at him in anger. Or perhaps I just would have cried. I said, no, I want my father back. I've taught so many children by now who grew up not knowing any father. I want to tell you, they miss their fathers. And one of the troubles that they bear is an anger at this missing man in their lives. And that makes it hard to learn, hard to deal with authority, hard to exist. They're angry at the man who's not there and he should be there for them. And meanwhile, we have society saying, hey, you know what? You've got it just as good as anybody else. It makes no difference whether you have a father or mother. And it absolutely contradicts his own experience and his own feelings. In the stable suburban Philadelphia neighborhood that I grew up in after we moved from the Bronx to Philadelphia, where my aunt was a professor at Penn, I found out, actually rather recently, from a childhood friend in elementary school, I was known in the elementary school as the boy without a father, which makes me long for the 1950s again. I was the boy without a father. Everybody else had a father and a mother at home. I was the odd one. It's true, though. Two women can raise children. Two men can raise children. That's certainly been done. Orphanages can raise children. Monasteries have sometimes raised children in the history of the world. All right, all these things. A village can raise a child. Trying to see who's up on old books.
Right. A village can raise a child. That's really what happens in a lot of tribes. I was just reading about somebody did a lot of neat research in the New Guinea Highlands. This was from the talk 2 nights ago. Why do these tribes fight all the time? By the way, the casualty rate there is just astonishing. It actually beats Poland during the 1940s. And to beat Poland for casualty rate during the 1940s is to just unimaginably violent. Right? So in that world, when a boy is born, his uncles are just as important to him as his father. Why? Because he may be raised by the uncles, as likely as anything, because the father may well be killed in some fight over women, pigs, and revenge. That's causes of war up there. But biological father and mother, that's best. How do we know this? I'm going to say four ways we know this. Certain ways appeal to more people more than others. So if you're talking to somebody, you may not start with what I'm going to put number one. You may start with what I'm going to put number four. But there are converging lines of evidence that the best way to raise children is with their biological father and mother. By the way, I think the second best is adoption. Right, you're raised with a biological father and mother who aren't your father and mother, but they've adopted you. And I know lots of adopted children in our church who really appreciate their fathers and mothers. So I think that's the best substitute. How do we know? Well, first of all, let's look at just the way the Bible is written. There are 10 commandments. There's only one commandment directed to parents and children, and it's directed entirely to children. Honor your father and mother that your days may be long on the land which the Lord your God gives you. Honor your father and mother. Doesn't say honor your parents. I've occasionally heard Christians revise that commandment to honor your parents. And I want to say, don't do that. There's a reason it says father and mother. Father and mother are not interchangeable parts. We'll get to that in a minute. So honor your father and mother. The book of Proverbs has a great deal about children. My son, listen to the instruction of your father and honor the words of your mother. A foolish child is sorrow to his mother and bitterness to his father. And you can, there are dozens of these proverbs that all assume that a child is being raised by father and mother. I started a series of sermons a while back in our church on marriage through the Bible. And I said, you know what? I'm going to take every book of the Bible and I'll bet you there is some serious teaching about marriage in every book of the Bible. And I'm up to the last sermon was on 1 Kings, and I preached a sermon on a loving couple, Ahab and Jezebel. And by the way, you remember Ahab was unhappy one time because he can't get the vineyard of Naboth who's next door to him. And so he goes home and he sulks and he turns to the wall and he won't eat. And his loving, considerate wife comes in and says, "My dear husband, what is the matter? Why won't you eat?" And he says, "Well, I asked Naboth for his vineyard and he wouldn't sell it to me." And she says, there, dear, get up and eat. I'll take care of it for you." Some of you know how she did that. All right, so there's something there about marriage between Ahab and Jezebel. I hope you know I didn't follow up with Jezebel as a wonderful example of a good wife. But anyway, there's a husband and wife there. The second line of thinking is that it's universal practice. The logic of life and of human affection just points towards husband, wife, and children. And there's a deep longing for children, and there's a deep longing for a father and a mother. You can look at contrary efforts. Contrary efforts. The kibbutz in Israel. Interesting social experiment. The idealists, the socialist idealists, most of them from Germany, who start the kibbutzim in the 1920s and 1930s, and they continue on through the 40s and 50s. When I was in school in the early 60s, the kibbutz was still an idealistic lodestar for a lot of my classmates that I went to school with. The kibbutz aimed to have the children raised by the village, not by their father and mother. And if anybody was ever going to make this experiment work, those are the people to make it work. They were as committed as you could possibly find, and everybody bought in, and it has broken down after about two generations. Why did it break down? Well, it broke down because actually the children want their own father and mother, and the father and mother actually want their own children. And
In the end, the people running the kibbutzim had to simply acknowledge the seemingly innate human attachment of biological father and biological mother with biological children simply overrode the ideology that had been so embraced by everybody who founded these kibbutzim. You have another contrary example in the American urban and rural underclass, where men and women mate and then the males take off. Doesn't have good results. And nobody right now is saying it has good results. But you have a large-scale social experiment right now in this country with the what we might call the social underclass. By the way, Europe's doing the same experiment and getting the same unhappy results. Children raised by harried, overworked, often underfunded women with men floating in and out of their lives do not grow up stable, happy, and productive people. It's a failed experiment. And then there's just general family outcomes research. The sociologists have been busy away for the last 40 years publishing their papers in journals, and when the results point towards you get much better results with a father and mother and biological children, they're filed away. Everybody knows how the results come out right now, but nobody wants to acknowledge them. Why? Because we're still in the midst of our sexual revolution, and that points right away from that sexual revolution that our society's leaders have embraced as good and desirable and not to be toyed with. There is a book just recently published. I've read several reviews of it. I took note of it because it was written by a graduate of the college I went to, Swarthmore College. And this researcher has gone around the world and looked at the selective sex abortions being done in China and India and other places. And there are millions and millions of missing baby girls in China and India, where you can statistically say somebody's killing these girls. There's no doubt about it. This is not any natural variation in the proportion of boys and girls born. And she is just outraged at this. The book is just a landmine on the abortion issue. And she writes at the end of the book that her only fear is that the worst possible outcome of her research might be that it might be used by somebody to restrict abortion. Now, she can't control how people read her book, so that's too bad for that. But I thought, worst possible outcome to restrict abortion? Worst possible outcome? Don't we have our worst possible outcome already with millions of baby girls killed before they're born? And don't think that isn't happening in this country, because it is also not on the same scale. So we're still in the middle of the sexual revolution, and nobody wants evidence that points in the other direction, but boy, is it out there. Conclusion. The social institution for optimal human reproduction has a name. It's called marriage. It's nature's way. It's God's way. There are two historic distortions. I want to name the two historic distortions. Prostitution and polygamy. Prostitution, male and female get together, but there is no lasting union, and if there's a child, it just belongs to the prostitute. And polygamy, man has more than one wife. There are a few societies where a wife may have more than one husband, but they are very rare. It's almost always a man has more than one wife. Gay marriage is a new idea. Not very many new ideas come along. And I'm trying to put this new idea in the context of old ideas, but a new idea. Now, I'm going to argue that this is not marriage. Why? Well, because two men can't have a child together. Two women can't have a child together. And it is at the heart of marriage that it looks towards the bearing of children. Marriage, by the way, in the Confession of Faith, is not essentially about love between two people. You can read chapter 24, and guess what? The word love is never mentioned. That doesn't mean husband and wife shouldn't love each other, but that's not what defines a marriage. You could be married and dislike each other. Lots of husbands and wives dislike each other. In fact, I dare say that all husbands and wives, at least some of the time, dislike each other.
If I knew you all better, I'd say, all of you married people here, have you at some time disliked the person you're married to? And I know what would happen. Each of you would sort of glance at the other one and wonder if you have permission to put your hand up. And then say, maybe it wouldn't be wise. And I'd see a little bit of this going on. So it is true, husbands and wives should love each other. But that is not what marriage is all about. Love is not what makes a marriage a marriage. Trying to look and see who's in this audience here this morning. The Christian church historically said, what makes in the end a marriage, you know what the church said it was? The marriage night. The marriage had to be consummated. And by consummated, it means for the first time, the man and the woman, we hope for the first time, the man and the woman sexually became one flesh. And they're talking about a particular kind of sex, not just any old sex game that people play. Talking about a particular kind of sex. Husband and wife become one flesh, marriage night traditionally. Then the marriage is consummated. So in Catholic teaching, if you can go and say, our marriage was never consummated, then you don't get a divorce, you get an annulment. Because the essence of marriage wasn't the ceremony in the church. The essence of marriage was when you went to bed together that night. And if you didn't do it, then it wasn't really a marriage and it could be annulled. That's basic Christian teaching. I think I can get away with this. I had a one of a couple in our congregation who... I got my wife really nervous now. they're like us. They're definitely past childbearing age. And so the question was, all right, we're definitely past childbearing age. So why do we still bother having sex? And I think I know the answer. If marriage is a covenant, it needs a sign of the covenant. If you guys know your covenant theology. What's the sign that a man and a woman are married? Well, we have an outward sign. It's the ring that we wear, although that's not got a biblical origin. The Puritans wanted to do away with rings, by the way. Because it doesn't have a biblical origin. The sign that you're married is that you periodically become one flesh sexually. You might call it a marriage sacrament. And the way you thought of it that way. But I think that's my answer. Why do old men and old women still... show that they're married? Well, they are showing they're married. Marriage is rooted in God-designed biology. It's how reproduction takes place, and it's how children get best reared. Now, at this point, usually there's quite a strong objection made, and it goes this way. You rotten hypocrite. You allow infertile people to marry. Although, by the way, the doctors don't always know who's fertile and who's infertile, but that's a different issue. You allow infertile people to marry. You allow old people to marry that nobody thinks are going to have children. It's only Abraham and Sarah once upon a time, a long time ago. But otherwise, you let old people. I have a friend in his mid-70s just married again and married somebody in the 60s. And nobody's objecting. Nobody's saying you shouldn't get married because you can't have children. So when people like you say marriage is all about children, you are a hypocrite. And you're just using that as a cover for your bigotry, which is an anti-gay bigotry, which you're now expressing. Now, I have what I call the Charlie Brown answer to this. I'm going to give two answers, a Charlie Brown answer and a story. First, the Charlie Brown answer. Charlie Brown, famously in the Peanuts strip, is manager of a baseball team. What is one thing you know about Charlie Brown's baseball team? It's never going to win a game. It is never going to win a game. All right, when you read the strip and you know it's baseball time and Charlie Brown's the manager, you know whatever happens, that he... But what's the point of... What is he aiming at? He's aiming at winning the game. So the whole team is organized and structured. All the activity is aimed and has this goal in mind. Win a game. They never do. Does this mean they're not a baseball team? No, they're a baseball team. They are oriented towards winning baseball games. They're a baseball team. No team ever gets together and orients itself towards losing.
Not necessarily a gambler on the side paying them. All right? But otherwise, nobody is oriented. I used to hate it when I was a kid and people say, you know, the game isn't about winning or losing. It's about having fun playing. And as a kid, I'd say, oh, well, you cut it out, coach. I'm here to win. I like to win. I hate to lose. And I don't want you as the coach telling me the point isn't to win, because my point is to win. And that's how I have fun. Charlie Brown's team wanted to win. They always lost. But they're still oriented towards winning. The sexual relations between husband and wife are oriented towards having children. That doesn't mean children always result. But that is the kind of a relationship that can and does produce children. So it is a true marriage between unlikes, male and female. That is the basis of human society and existence. Now a story. Very different. This story about a farmer. And I think I told this story in a different connection last night. A story about a farmer. And he had a farm in Iowa. He loved being a farmer. In fact, he loved being a farmer so much he would sometimes just sort of imitate ancient farming methods that Jesus refers to in his parable of the sower. And he'd go out sometimes and he'd have his seed, and he'd scatter the seed, and some would fall on the road and the birds would eat it. Nothing would grow. And he'd throw the seed and some would grow on rocky ground, and it would start to grow, but then no roots because of the rocks underneath, and you get no crop. And he'd throw some seed on good soil, and the fall would come and you get a crop. You're going to harvest it and you get to eat. And a fellow moved out to the countryside from the center of Chicago. Never seen a farm before in his life. He's out of Chicago now, and he buys a little house next to the farmer. And no land attached to it, just a little house. And he sits there and he watches the farmer for about a year. And he says, there's a happy man. There's a happy man. As he goes about his work, throwing the seed on the ground. So he goes over to the farmer and he says, what do you call what you do? Farmer says, this is farming. Chicago guy says, you know what? I'm going to be a farmer too. Farmer says, oh, really? He says, yes, I am. I'm going to take seed and I'm going to plant it just like you. So he buys some seed and he looks around, but he's got no land on which to throw the seed. None. So he gets a pot out of the kitchen and he puts the pot on his front porch and he puts seed into the pot. And then the next day he puts more seed into the pot. And then he waters the pot, and he puts the pot in the sun, and he puts more seed into the pot. The farmer comes over after a couple of weeks and says, what are you doing? I'm farming. That's not farming. You got to have dirt. You got to put the seed on the dirt, then you can farm. The guy says, no. Farming is when you throw seed around and love what you're doing. You throw seed around and you love what you're doing. That's farming. I throw seed around. I love what I'm doing. That's farming. Farmer says, you're never going to get a crop this way. He says, that's not the point. The point is to love what you're doing and to farm. And I'm farming. Well, the farmer finally looked at him and gave him the look he deserves and said, well, you know what? You can eat your love. I'm going to eat my crop. Marriage is the comprehensive union of a male and a female looking toward the begetting and rearing of children. That's a shortened version of this. Everybody can play sex games that God forbids outside of marriage. By the way, this is why our society hates the biblical sexual ethic. It's quite demanding. It says sexual behavior is for a man and a woman who've taken on the burdens of marriage. And says, otherwise, it's not for you. It's very strict. And our society hates it. So you can disobey God and have all kinds of sex games outside of marriage. But there's only one kind of sexual relation that can produce a child. And I won't go on to all the other varieties of games people play. It's only one. And that is the marriage between a man and a woman of a certain sort, that we'll call one flesh marriage or one flesh sex. It's not up to the church or state to determine who can or who will be fertile. Doctors are often wrong. I know this from experience. We have 5 children. We intended to have 3 children. Doctors are often wrong, and the objection is therefore invalid. We are quite consistent. Marriage is only for the sorts of relations that are oriented towards bearing and begetting children. Now, there's a practical problem. What do we call a gay couple when we meet one? At least I ran into this. My department supervisor had a series of boyfriends all through the time that I was a teacher with him, and he invited us out to his Christmas party, and you could tell it was Christmas party, and no woman ever stepped into his life. I just had a series of boyfriends. So what do you call these two that are together? Well, we already have a name for them. Do you know what it is? It's an okay name. Friends. They're friends. It's a good name. Male-male friendship is a good thing, not a bad thing. Female-female friendship is a good thing, not a bad thing. Many male-male friendships provide mutual help. This is why I prefer the Catholic and the Heidelberg way of reversing these, by the way. They provide mutual help. You can even have some sort of division of labor. What's the one thing a male-male friendship can't do? Produce a child. What's the one thing a female-female friendship can't do? Produce a child. Is this incidental to social living? No, it's not incidental. No children in Robinson Crusoe is gone in 100 years with all the Fridays in the world you can imagine. The ongoing life of society depends upon a large number of male-female unions producing children. So it's not incidental. Now, I want to know something else about friendships, how they're different from marriages. Friendships need not be either permanent nor exclusive. Marriage is ideally permanent and exclusive. The 7th commandment says, "You shall not commit adultery." It's exclusive. Permanent, it's for as long as you both shall live. So that's the ideal of marriage, both permanent and exclusive. But friendships don't have to be permanent, and they don't have to be exclusive. We've all had impermanent friendships and non-exclusive friendships. Why don't they have to be permanent or exclusive? Well, there are no children involved. So the stakes are not at all the same. Friendships can be grounded in common interest. And there is no good reason to confuse right now marriage with friendship and friendship with marriage. What's happening is the category of marriage has actually gotten collapsed into the category of friendship, and then the whole thing has gotten renamed marriage. That's what's going on. The category of marriage is dumbed down to mutual affection and maybe mutual support, which you can have in any kind of a friendship. Many friendships have that. So that's the redefinition of marriage. It's collapsed into friendship. And then it's recalled and renamed marriage. It's a neat semantic trick our society is engaging in. What's one of the consequences? You know, one of the sad consequences is it is now making many, many male-male friendships suspect. And making many female-female friendships suspect. And you even have people who now read the Bible, and we read about David and Jonathan and say, "Man, they were such good friends, they must have been gay lovers." Right, that's a fairly common misreading at this point in 1 Samuel. All right, so male-male friendships begin, and it's getting harder, not easier, to form male-male friendships and female-female friendships because of the confusion that our society is indulging in where marriage is concerned. You know what? This church is not well-equipped. In my church, there is in the back a great big clock about like this, so that everybody knows I can see the clock. And I don't even have a watch with me up here. 11:05. You know what? I've gone long enough. I'm 1/3 through this talk, and you do not want me going on. I will give you the outline of the rest of the talk. Point 2. Social basics. Marriage unites the unlike parts of society, male and female. in a society of all men, there is no need for a book entitled Understanding the Mind of a Woman. And in all male society, with all male unions, nobody is going to sing a song saying, why can't a woman be like a man? As in Fair, My Fair Lady. It is a society where there is no mutual interest between men and women. By the way, it turns out to be a very unpleasant place for women. I want to just tell one anecdote. When we were in Athens, we lived in Athens 1978-79, and I had a Fulbright grant, so we had a connection with the U.S. Embassy, so we got invited to U.S. Embassy functions. So I'd go to these and ran into some interesting people, diplomatic refugees from Iran during the revolution, giving a picture of Tehran before the Shah fell. Not a happy place for women then. A lot less happy since then. Friends from Saudi Arabia. What it costs the wife to live in Saudi Arabia. Beginning with, can't drive. Most memorable, two women who were anthropologists who'd spent their entire year in a Nile Delta village, just doing their anthropology thing. How does this village work? And they slowly came to the conclusion there wasn't a single straight man in the village. Not one. The men often had wives because they wanted children, but they did not have any interest in their wives. They only burned with interest for other men. And these two feminist anthropologists from a mainline Ivy League university found themselves increasingly appalled as they realized what a loveless place for the women this was. No man was interested in any of them. I myself do not believe that the percentages are fixed at all. I think they are influenced by lots of things. And so marriage is about the most fundamental way socially that the two parts of the human race live our mutual interdependence on each other. And to go back to biology, God has made it so we have to be independent to each other, because if we don't live that way, in one generation we're all gone, and when we're old there's nobody to take care of us. Third part of the talk that I am now just quickly skimming through. The Bible uses marriage as a picture of Christ and his church. What happens to that picture if we change how we understand marriage? Well, it obviously gets seriously damaged and undermined. Now, sexual revolution was dumbing down marriage a long time before the gay marriage oxymoron came into existence. The old view was, if you were married, it was part of your human duty, if you good and God gave them to you, to have children. That is now viewed as a quite retrograde view, and it means that marriage demands less than it used to. Commitment is now increasingly conditional, rather than, now I'm married, I've done it. Cost is low. So marriage isn't the same challenge to selfishness as it used to be. Meanwhile, we've made the benefits pretty high. You get health insurance on your as a spouse often. There are tax benefits. There are Social Security goodies. And there are privileges for visiting each other in the hospital, by the way, which I think stem from insane privacy rules that only recognize one kind of relationship, marriage, family. Which means that two friends can no longer mutually support each other when one goes in the hospital. This is a mistake on the part of our society, to tie everything so closely to family when it comes to hospital and mutual care. Three basics about marriage make it strictly a male-female thing. Biological basic, social basic, uniting the two human halves, and a redemptive basic, a spiritual purpose to picture Christ and his church. I think it's important for the Christian church to pay attention to this issue, even if we lose the social battle for the wider society. Why? Because our thinking has not been really clear on the subject of what marriage is. And it's important now for the church to get clear and think clearly, what is marriage? Here is the Confession of Faith summarized. What is marriage? Marriage is a covenant of lifelong fidelity between a man and a woman to live as one flesh, for their mutual benefit and for the bearing of children, or perhaps for their bearing of children and for their mutual benefit. Thank you all for listening patiently. The next talk is quite different. It's about not being married and finding somebody to marry. It will not be a how-to course. It will be a, if somebody tells you how to, throw the book away. You'll see. Thank you.